note. The golden-cheeked warbler is a star performer. Boldly dressed in yellow, black, and white, these little birds and their buzzy song take center stage in Texas Hill Country. The golden-cheeked warbler is an endangered species and the only bird that nests exclusively in central Texas. Males arrive in March to stake out a territory in the juniper oak woodlands. The older the trees, the better. While the female handles most of the nest construction and defense, both parents bring home the bugs to their hungry chicks. Look for them chasing insects on the wing or gleaning grubs from high in the canopy. By the end of July, the warblers are on their way back to mountain forests of southern Mexico and Central America. Golden-cheeked warblers can't survive without healthy, mature woodlands, but deforestation has destroyed and fragmented much of their habitat across the Americas. Now, this special songbird's future depends on people stepping up to protect our forests, from Nicaragua to Texas. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is dedicated to naturalist Dave Sutherland from Boulder, Colorado, who has taught so many so much.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me, as usual, is Brandon. Right off the bat, we're reading Guy or Guy Debord's The Commodity of Spectacle. We're reading some very short excerpts from it. We're going to read live. He writes in aphoristic style, kind of similar to Nietzsche, where it's a bunch of very numbered short paragraphs that individually have their own specific ideas or hypotheses, but all kind of circle the drain on the same general idea and major sort of theory and concept. So we're going to kind of read through some of those, discuss them as we go. But before we do, I think our listeners kind of know that we've got our quote and quandary sort of opener for the first little bit. I've got both a quote and a quandary today. Why don't I jump? I'm going to take the lead and jump in with my quandary. My quandary could easily be an episode in itself. We're going to really quickly throw this out here, and then we're going to let it go for now. Maybe we'll return. But as our listeners, if people tuned in last week or some prior episodes, lately I've been reading a little bit of Aristotle, and in particular, I've also been reading Jonathan Lear's Aristotle, The Desire to Understand, which is a pretty well-known and fantastic kind of companion guide, academic, generalized review of Aristotelian thought. And as I was reading through, the first few chapters are devoted largely at the end of the day to the idea of form. You know, anyone who's sort of familiar with philosophy, especially ancient philosophy and metaphysics, or Greco-Roman ancient philosophy and metaphysics, all that kind of stuff, will immediately, the term form, will immediately be, you know, total, you'll recognize it immediately. Sorry, that's what I was looking for. It needs no introduction, right? You know, Plato's World of Forms, and then Aristotle really takes up the mantle. We really can't go too much into like what Aristotle's version of forms is, but really like the my super layman synopsis is forms are the instantiated structure of any articulated being from its becoming to actualizing to passing away. It's the overarching sort of just, you know, form, structure, purpose, all that kind of stuff encapsulated into like what this thing is, sort of the end, another way of kind of saying it could be essence, essentially, right? That kind of thing. My quandary was kind of this, which was Plato famously came up with the theory of forms, right? Now, his theory of forms was, as many of our listeners will probably know, is kind of external, and this idea that it's forms is sometimes analogous with the word term ideas, which basically means, again, to simplify Platonic metaphysics, out there in the world is a, you know, is a perfect version of everything that exists. Sorry, I shouldn't say out there in the world, but beyond the world, transcending the world, is, you know, a perfect version of everything that exists. And basically anything that you interact with, whether it's yourself as a person or a cup or a table or a triangle or whatever, is imperfect reflection of that perfect form. That's the simplest version, right? Now, the obvious problem or kind of attack on this is that, you know, well, where is this perfect realm of forms, right? Like, this whole argument hinges on this sort of transcendental, almost spiritual, like kind of heavenly, there's this realm beyond where the forms exist. And, you know, Aristotle saw that as a problem. People ever since reading Plato have seen that as a problem. It's kind of like, how do you make heads of tails of that? Like, you know, it's basically, it almost becomes a faith sort of practice at a certain point. So Aristotle turns around and says, no, form is instantiated in the beings. My quandary kind of comes in as I was reading Aristotle and reading Jonathan Lear's, I sort of started to wonder myself, did Aristotle just turn the problem inside out? Did he not actually solve the problem of forms or ideas or essence, but instead just said, no, they're located it actually within or a part of, you know, any particular entity or being? But again, you're still then sort of left with the question of, okay, well, where exactly is the form? You say it's like just a part of the chair, but it's like, could the concept form really a part of any particular being or entity out there? Or is this just a concept and it's not actually instantiated in that? And when Aristotle kind of believes that it is instantiated in a particular being, well, now you're just left with basically the reversed kind of problem that you had with Plato, where now it's something that's so completely internalized, but again, its locale, its location, its definition is sort of still kind of mystical or hard to pin down.
Another way of thinking of this is that we still have the problem of abstraction, right? By turning the problem inside out, that means to say that if Plato had an abstraction problem, that is, that the form of a thing seems to be some distance or in some like other world, and you ask the question, well, where is the form of, say, like a chair, and you say it's in some other world, Aristotle tries to solve the problem by bringing that form into our world, but you can still ask the question, okay, well, where is it in our world?
It doesn't really provide an adequate answer. And so I just, it's exactly as you said, it's the problem of abstraction is still there. And maybe I should reword my problematization of this and say, it went from being outside in, right? Like, the forms went from being this, external thing to now being this internal thing. But again, it's like, where is the form now?
I think you're right to say that this could definitely be like its own episode, and maybe I should hang on to my answer to allow that to be its own episode. But, you know, if this is anticipating an episode, then I'll anticipate my answer by saying that in a certain way, Aristotle actually does solve this problem by also borrowing what Plato himself says, which is that the form is kind of out there. The thing is not just a reflection as if there's like some distance. It's actually like a shadow of that thing. And it's also one of the things that Plato is trying to do with his theory of forms, is he's trying to explain difference and sameness. So when you point to two chairs and you say they're the same chair, they participate in the same form, right? So the form is actually in the chair. It's just that the eternal form for it is in some other realm doing its own thing, being eternal, being separate from our world of being and becoming. Aristotle tries to solve that by saying, look, two chairs do have the same form, but they have the same form by virtue of structure and whatnot. And yet they are the same. They have the same form in the same way that Plato says that two chairs have the same identical form. So, and the reason that solves the problem of abstraction is because if the, if in Plato's answer, the form is in that chair, it's just a shadowy version of it kind of being shown and appearing. For Aristotle, the form is in that, it literally is that thing, right? It almost is its essence. Another word that later on gets used is it is, it has hiseity, right? It has its thisness, or it has its whatness about it, that what that is its form. And the question of like, okay, well, where is it in the world is, when you point at the chair, it's right there.
Yeah, and I kind of, like, in my own thinking, I sort of, that I kind of came to a similar sort of conclusion at the same sort of sense, where it's like, but again, it's sort of like, there is this problem, I think, where you still could ostensibly just kind of leave the whole concept of form out, effectively, and be like, it's just chairs.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah, there's like this... idea of like, if a thing just is its form, then why even talk about its form, and why not just talk about what it is?
Exactly. Yeah. And now I do have a quote as well, because we don't want to stand for too long. Did you also have a quote or a quandary?
I think I have a quote, but I think we should leave it to moving into our next, in the work we're going to be talking about.
Then why don't I'll do my quick quote as well, and another quote jumping off another area. This is a quote I came across. Actually, ostensibly, it was between a Russian astronaut sometime during the Soviet period and a brain surgeon. I just thought it was an interesting quote reflecting the kind of mind-body problem. A Russian astronaut and a Russian brain surgeon were once discussing religion. The brain surgeon was Christian, but the astronaut was not. The astronaut says, "I've been out in space many times, but I've never seen God or angels." And the brain surgeon replied, "And I've operated on many clever brains, but I've never once seen a single thought." I just thought that was an interesting, if for any of our listeners that are familiar with that kind of, one of the classic epistemological problems, the mind-body problem, right, of the fact that there is still, to this day, this great debate of the immateriality of the subjective experience and, you know, the operations of one's mental space and psychology and stuff like that, that just doesn't seem, you know, there's the bridge between that and the material functionality of, you know, neurons and brain activity and all that kind of stuff, is still kind of eludes us to this day as one of these kind of problems. Now, obviously, this quote, sort of the brain surgeon says, well, then this is basically proof of spirit in some sort of way, and, you know, a justification for kind of religious belief. But ultimately, it still is to this day oftentimes cited as a justification for some sort of belief in the immaterial aspects of reality.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, right? I mean, when we have... Yeah, this is... immediately when we start talking in terms like this, it becomes very difficult to keep our footing, because we're kind of giving into the dualist framework by trying to talk about experiences that we have in some sense, or in some like material sense, that there is this, like, you know, maybe my Wittgenstein is like showing, but that there is this idea of like an experience that we can have and somehow find the sort of material manifestations of that or something like that. It's already, you know, a bit concessive as far as trying to reduce our experiences to something or applying criterias that really only apply to like one side of something. What is so compelling about the mind-body problem just is the apparent fact that we have these subjective, intangible experiences, and yet there's no apparent physical manifestation of them, whether in the brain or anything like that. I mean, again, this could be like a whole episode on its own too, and but specifically about like you know, the sort of way that I'm tackling this, of like, it's more a conceptual problem of cordoning off and prioritizing one side of a dichotomy and trying to explain one side in terms of the other, right? Like, you could easily, like, I don't know if like easily as in like convincingly, but there is, like, every time this comes up, I always wonder why things like nerve endings don't count as part of the brain, even though they're attached to the brain. You know, like, that's like saying that when two people are on a telephone communicating, the telephone wires aren't really part of the telephone. Aren't part of the communication. It's just the people talking that are part of the communication. But it's obvious that the telephone lines are part of the communication. You know, when your hand touches something, that's the manifestation. That's the physical aspect of it. You know, when you feel something in a subjective experience, your hand is the thing touching it, and those are the neurons. There's no like neurons in your hand, but that's the part of your brain interfacing with the world and having that experience. But we are kind of neuromaniacal and like brain centric.
Yeah, we have a tendency, when it comes to our mental activity, we tend to be very like reductive in terms of thinking about everything in terms of like brain states and this sort of mental, like you said, the sort of mental electrical neuron activity. But obviously, I think many, psychologists and neurologists and philosophers and people like that have sort of postulated this more expansive version of consciousness and psychology, and with it, the material activity that doesn't just focus on like one's brain activity as a seat of consciousness, but like the interface and actual placement and specific activity and reality, that all that is sort of mixed together and operating as like one thing rather than just this like brain in a vat type of vision.
Yeah, where the boundaries between our bodies and our environments are much more fluid than we suppose.
You had a quote.
This will be a way of jumping into Debord. My quote is from the introduction by Hannah Arendt to Walter Benjamin's Illuminations. And it's kind of like, it's not a sketch, but in a certain way, it is a kind of profile of Paris, where Guy Debord himself was born and raised, and which had a profound influence on Walter Benjamin's kind of psychology and his approach. He kind of considered himself like an honorary Frenchman in the way that he wrote and collected. But the quote is, it's a little bit long, but we'll read it as a way into discussing Debord's ideas, because I think they are a little bit illuminating about what we'll be talking about. So, to this day, Paris is the only one among the large cities which can be comfortably covered on foot. And more than any other city, it is dependent for its liveliness on the people who pass by in the streets, so that the modern automobile traffic endangers its very existence not only for technical reasons. The wasteland of an American suburb, or the residential districts of many towns, where all of the street life takes place on the roadway and where one can walk on the sidewalks, by now reduced to footpaths for miles on end without encountering a human being, is the very opposite of Paris. What all other cities seem to permit only reluctantly to the dregs of society, strolling, idling, flaneury, which is like going about, just kind of like idle going about your day. Paris streets actually invite everyone to do. Thus, ever since the Second Empire, the city has been the paradise of all those who need to chase after no livelihood, pursue no career, reach no goal. The paradise then of bohemians, and not only of artists and writers, but of all those who have gathered about them because they could not be integrated either politically, being homeless or stateless, or socially. So I say this by way of kind of introduction to the society of the spectacle, and specifically the kind of first couple passages that we will be discussing, because I think it offers a really good profile of what Guy Debord takes seriously, right? It's not like a metaphysic or anything. Like, if you want to understand why something matters to a philosopher, you understand their metaphysics, because that structures the universe they live in. And Guy Debord does live in a metaphysical, you know, universe. He thinks that there are, like, structures and whatnot. But this is a sort of geographical or psychogeographical picture of Debord's kind of internal world, as it were, that the world is one where one can go about and encounter people in authentic situations, and there are real people who are living their lives and appearing so get to live their life in in the way that they appear authentically, without sort of mediation. You can go out into the streets and you can meet people, you can talk to them. There isn't any kind of again, I'm like anticipating what we'll be talking about, but there's no real like mediation in terms of televisions or like internet or advertising or anything like that. Obviously there's exchange, there's trade, there's commerce, but it's even that is a bit more authentic. Like, you have the Parisian chef or the baker or something like that, who really has an authentic pursuit of their craft or anything like that. And you really can talk to them about that. So when Debord is describing the alienation of this, this is kind of against the backdrop of the Parisian life that he lived within. It's maybe a little bit reductive, but I think it does go to paint a bit of a picture as to, maybe contributing why something like this matters to Debord so much. And not only that, but like the situation and the context within which these kinds of encounters matter to him.
So number one, in societies where modern conditions of production prevail, all of life presents itself as an immense accumulation of spectacles. Everything that was directly lived has moved away into a representation. Debord is now kind of negating this sort of world that you were describing as the classic Paris, the sort of classic active community, and saying that everything is directly lived everything that was directly lived, so the kind of directly lived is, I think, kind of what you were explaining earlier, that description earlier, has moved away into representation, and representation is through spectacles. So I think the obvious thing to think about first with this is that, like, the interface, the way human beings or communities, societies, socialities sort of interact, now has a intermediary aspect to it. It's no longer direct, and that intermediary aspect is representation. So, like, what could that mean? Well, like, it can mean something as simple as, like, you know, if you and I are having a conversation, say we just have a conversation face to face, that's like this kind of direct, more authentic interaction, versus if we only ever interface through a medium, you know, you and I talk through, you know, online through the computer while recording all these episodes, stuff, that's a medium. But even something as simple as perhaps letter writing or whatever, these sorts of mediums, if that's all we ever do, are going to sort of have certain conditions and constraints on the way that we present ourselves and what can be communicated and how it's communicated, et cetera, et cetera. Again, like we talked about so many times on our media episodes, it's this sort of medium is the message. We're kind of getting into that territory like immediately.
Yeah, the other thing that's interesting to note about this first passage as well is that the last sentence reads, everything that was directly lived has moved away into representation. So it's important to note that there is something that has degraded or moved away, right? That everything that was directly lived, so again, these encounters, these particular lifestyles, or even the freedom to do so, and the kind of feeling of this experience of being able to choose or not choose how you sort of encounter and engage with the world, has moved away into a representation. So those experiences themselves, it is mediums that we think, when we think in terms of like media theory, you know, the emergence of like the phone, of television. The TV was, for Dubord, kind of the spectacle, right? But what he's talking about here, too, is that those mediums mediate representations of a thing that was previously there, right? So we're being offered up something that we had before. And it's in that way that it's not... We'll talk about how this mediation goes about more, but it's that where there was direct sort of contact with people, we now have this middleman between us. And that middleman, it specifically is that prior sort of encounter before, right?
The middleman sort of takes the place of, or sort of contorts that prior interaction into, you know, as say, moves it away in the sense of it doesn't completely change it, but moves it away into its now representative form.
2. The images detached from every aspect of life fuse in a common stream in which the unity of this life can no longer be reestablished. Reality considered partially unfolds in its own general unity as a pseudo-world apart, an object of mere contemplation. The specialization of images of the world is completed in the world of the autonomous image, where the liar has lied to himself. The spectacle in general, as the concrete inversion of life, is the autonomous movement of the non-living. So it's starting to get pretty, already we're getting a bit heady, but in general, what has been said kind of anticipates what's already going on, right? So we should say what's been added here. What's been added is not just that these representations that are the spectacle emerge. First of all, the first passage suggests that they exist, but the second one is suggesting something about their nature, which is that they're autonomous, right? That there's something about them that when they emerge, they sort of have a life of their own, that we're not really in control of the ways, because if that representation is mediating our relationships and our encounters with people, then we're not really in control of the thing that mediates those things prior now, or is now mediating those things. So we've lost control of how we encounter each other.
Yeah, in the first sentence, fuse in a common stream in which the unity of life can no longer be reestablished. So again, like talking back to that kind of like classic sort of view of like the community and social interaction and all this kind of stuff. Well, now this has been, you know, shifted, and really this has been split apart. And as you said, you know, all these new sort of mediums, these new medias and mediums have sort of established themselves. But there's a way in which they're also kind of, like, I want to use the term organic in the sense of, like, they're not necessarily, like, totally controlled or contrived. And, like, one can think about something, like, as simple as, like, the internet or even things like television or advertising or whatever. Like, these are all, like, mediums and, like, media processes that, like, yeah, sure, they do have inventors and they do have technologists and scientists behind them, inventors and whatever it might be. But at the end of the day, they're also just kind of out there, like, operating and growing and, like, they're, and, sort of becoming the realm of social discourse, like the place where that, you know, kind of all happens and, you know, where we all interact with each other. They sort of have a life of their own in a way.
In a certain way, all of our direct experiences are mediated in some way, right? Like there's distance between us or there's language in some way. Unleashing new kinds of technologies, you can't test in advance the consequences of these things, right? When you unleash them as the inventor or the scientist, you don't know how that is going to affect the ways that we communicate. And that's kind of one of the aspects of how things become autonomous. They have, again, like going the classic kind of thesis that the medium is the message, that these things kind of operate according to their own logic. Dubord has other kind of ideas about the logic unifying these things because of the ways that the social, like the way that material and economic production for him is central to the way that these kinds of ideas are like governed So they do have like a kind of, you know, I was going to refer the listener to our previous episode when we discussed the critique of ideology, but